This is Bob Carroll. Welcome to another episode of Unnatural Virtue. Today's topic is debiasing and has been excerpted from my new book, The Critical Thinker's Dictionary. I'll begin with a quote from Daniel Kahneman. For some of our most important beliefs, we have no evidence at all, except that people we love and trust hold these beliefs. Considering how little we know, the confidence we have in our beliefs is preposterous. And it's also essential. Debiasing refers to methods, strategies, and techniques used to overcome biases in thinking. Many thinking biases are rooted in our evolutionary history. Some are rooted in cultural traditions, and some are due to a variety of personal and social factors. Biased thinking doesn't always lead to bad judgments or decisions. A bias is a tendency. If the foundation beneath that tendency is built of solid knowledge, recognized expertise and years of relevant experience, then something like the availability bias might lead to quick judgments or decisions, but not necessarily to bad ones. As Daniel Kahneman notes, expert intuition strikes us as magical, but it's not. Indeed, each of us performs feats of intuitive expertise many times each day. Most of us are pitch perfect in detecting anger in the first word of a telephone call, recognize as we enter into the room that we are the subject of the conversation, and quickly react to subtle signs that the driver of the car in the next lane is dangerous. The psychology of accurate intuition involves no magic. Perhaps the best short statement of it is by the great Herbert Simon, who studied chess masters and showed that after thousands of hours of practice, they come to see the pieces on the board differently from the rest of us. You can feel Simon's impatience with the mythologizing of expert intuition when he writes, "The situation has provided a cue. This cue has given the expert access to information stored in memory, and the information provides the answer. Intuition is nothing more and nothing less than recognition." Most of us, however, are not knowledgeable of most subjects, are not recognized experts in anything, and lack experience in most fields. Biased thinking for most of us, most of the time, might not be a problem. But for important matters, following our instincts may not be the best course of action. Cognitive biases, for most of us, most of the time, are cognitive illusions. Can we learn to overcome cognitive illusions? The evidence, according to Kahneman, one of the leading experts in the study of cognitive biases and illusions, is, quote, not encouraging. It's hard to accept that our minds are working in ways we have little control over, and that we know much less about ourselves than we think we do. Much of our thinking is automatic and can't be turned off at will. Kahneman notes, "Constantly questioning our own thinking would be impossibly tedious, much too slow and inefficient. The best we can do is a compromise. Learn to recognize situations in which mistakes are likely and try harder to avoid significant mistakes when the stakes are high." One bias we should all be concerned with is the bias that many of us have that favors intuition over scientific data. We might excuse a non-expert like Boris Johnson, who believes his experience of a very cold winter in England should be considered as strong evidence against the scientific consensus that the planet is warming up. But we should not excuse experts who don't recognize that the situation in which they are making decisions is one of low validity for predictability, yet they go ahead and follow intuition anyway without further investigation. Rabbi Avi Shafran reminds us of what can happen when we place too much confidence in intuition. In one of his wonderful collections of essays, The Youngest Science, Notes of a Medicine Watcher, the late physician Lewis Thomas tells us of a highly successful doctor, a senior citizen back when Dr. Thomas's father was an intern, in New York's Roosevelt Hospital, who was trained before the medical profession understood how disease spreads. The elder doctor was renowned for his remarkable ability to diagnose typhoid fever, a common disease at that time and place. His method was to closely examine the tongues of patients. His ward rounds, the younger Dr. Thomas recounts, were essentially tongue rounds. Each patient would stick out his tongue for the doctor to palpate. Pondering its texture and irregularities, he would diagnose the disease in its earliest stages over and over again, and turn out a week or so later to have been right, to everyone's amazement. The essayist Riley concludes, "He was a more productive carrier using only his hands than Typhoid Mary." Despite the obstacles that face all of us who attempt to overcome cognitive biases and illusions, the first step seems obvious. We must recognize and study the main biases and illusions so that we're aware of them and aware of what kinds of situations they frequently occur in. The second step seems obvious, too. Devise a plan for dealing with individual biases. At the very least, the second step requires a commitment to hard work and reflection before making a judgment. The third step may not seem obvious, especially to those who are overconfident in their ability to make important decisions quickly. Recognize what kinds of situations are inherently unpredictable and what kinds of situations allow time for getting feedback. It should go without saying that it is not wise to follow your intuition when the situation is predictably unpredictable, and it is wise to get feedback whenever possible before making important decisions. Ideally, I suppose, debiasing would be one of the primary objectives of education. What could be more important for a society than a populace that knows how to avoid some of the main hindrances to making good decisions and judgments? Yet few high school students, and most college students, will graduate without even knowing what these biases are, much less having been taught how to diminish their power over us. There's every reason to be pessimistic about the chances of successfully overcoming many cognitive biases and illusions. Nobody's made a more detailed and careful study of these biases and their effects than Daniel Kahneman, yet here's what he had to say at the end of his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Except for some effects that I attribute mostly to age, my intuitive thinking is just as prone to overconfidence, extreme predictions, and the planning fallacy as it was before I made a study of these issues. I have improved only in my ability to recognize situations in which errors are likely, and I have made much more progress in recognizing the errors of others than my own. Even so, there may be hope for us after all. For example, there may be little we can do to overcome the optimistic bias in individuals, but there is some evidence that we can reduce this bias in organizations. The optimistic bias is an expression used by Kahneman to describe the idea that most of us view the world as more benign than it really is, our own attributes as more favorable than they truly are, and the goals we adopt as more achievable than they're likely to be. Furthermore, most of us have an unrealistic view about predicting the future. We think we're much better at it than we really are. We might advise individuals, when considering their goals, that they ask themselves two questions. One, what could go wrong? And two, what would happen if I fail? A consideration of possible failure need not lead one to dismantle one's dreams. In fact, it could help prevent the very failures that one considers by planning ahead to avoid them. For organizations, Gary Klein has this advice. When the organization has almost come to an important decision but has not formally committed itself, Klein proposes gathering for a brief session a group of individuals who are knowledgeable about the decision. The premise of the session is a short speech. Imagine that we are a year into the future. We implemented the plan as it now exists. The outcome was a disaster. Please take 5 to 10 minutes to write a brief history of that disaster. Klein called his proposal a premortem. Kahneman comments, the premortem has two main advantages. It overcomes the groupthink that affects many teams once a decision appears to have been made, and it unleashes the imagination of knowledgeable individuals in a much-needed direction. The suppression of doubt contributes to overconfidence in a group where only supporters of the decision have a voice. The main virtue of the premortem is that it legitimizes doubts. Furthermore, it encourages even supporters of the decision to search for possible threats that they had not considered earlier. Another area where debiasing has shown some success is with the planning fallacy, a term coined by Kahneman and Amos Tversky, to describe plans and forecasts that are unrealistically close to best-case scenarios and could be improved by consulting the statistics of similar cases. To mitigate this tendency to be unrealistic about how long some task will take to accomplish, one should research similar tasks that have been accomplished and find out how long the proposers thought it would take and how long it actually took. According to Kahneman, quote, using distributional information from other ventures similar to that being forecasted is called taking an outside view and is the cure to the planning fallacy. This advice has been put into practice enough that it has its own name, reference class forecasting. The process has been used in the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Switzerland. Should we be optimistic? I don't know. On the other hand, there's not much to report regarding successful methods of debiasing individuals. Well, that's it for this episode of Unnatural Virtue. As noted earlier, today's material was excerpted from my new book, The Critical Thinker's Dictionary: Biases, Fallacies, and Illusions, and What You Can Do About Them. Until next time, please commit some unnatural acts in public. And don't forget, skepticism, though unnatural, is a virtue.